Thanks for checking out the Candeo podcast. To learn more about us, visit us at CandeoChurch.com.
Well, good morning, Candeo family. How are we doing today? Man, that is weak. I thought it was just the first service. Can we try that again? We're going to start this over. I'm going to pretend like I'm walking back up, give you a second chance. All right. Hey, good morning, Candeo family. How are we doing today? Okay, man, that's way better. Now I actually believe you when you're like, all right, I'm going to open my Bible. We're going to pay attention and dive in. So if you got a Bible, I'd love for you to join me in Mark 14. But I want to tell you first about one of my favorite life memories, and it clearly wasn't playing basketball. Okay, so I wrestled for like 13 years. That somebody asked me, they're like, was that the first time you'd ever dribbled the ball up the floor with one hand and done something else with the other hand? And I was like, that really was. And they filmed it and showed all of you. So you're welcome. Incredible skills. If you're going to do any basketball camps later this spring or summer, I'm available. Nobody's interested. Okay. Not my favorite life memory. Let me tell you this. So one of my favorite life memories was going ring shopping for my wife, Stacy. And fellas, if there's anybody in the room that's thinking about maybe an engagement day someday in your future, let me give you just some free advice. Take it or leave it. But here's my free advice. Is when you go shopping on the day, make that a life event. Okay, make that a life event. I want to tell a story a bit. I'd been thinking about proposing to Stacy for a while. We met in college. Well, we met prior to that, but really met in college. And God was really gracious and kind in that. But I remember that summer starting to think about, like, I'm ready to put a ring on this girl's finger. So that summer, I spent 2 months overseas in Thailand on a SALT summer missions team. And in that trip, you know, I bought a number of souvenirs for friends and family, but I decided to buy Stacy a ring just to see if I could get like her size figured out. Cause I was trying to think ahead of like, I need to know what size she's got cause I want to surprise her with a ring, right? So I buy this ring. I assumed like her like ring finger was roughly the size of my pinky. Nothing special about the ring, just this like thing I bought at a shop there that like they etched like the name of Jesus in Thai like on it. It was kind of cool, but it wasn't expensive, pretty cheap. In fact, when I gave it to her, she got it wet and it stained her finger green. Like it was like so cheap, but that wasn't the point. I just wanted to see if I got the size right and it fit perfectly. So about a week before we went ring shopping, I stole it. She had no idea where it went. I stole it and I've got that in my hand. I'm like, I just need to find something about this size. And grabbed four of my best friends and spent an entire day going through every jewelry store we could find and looking for what was the perfect ring. The perfect ring. And as I think back on it now, like I don't know if I've ever laughed as much at any one day as we did that one day. Like one moment that comes to mind is I remember we were in this one particular jewelry store, and either the gal like owned the place or her husband did, or she was just there for the employee discount because she had half of the store on her body. Like, I mean, it was like ears, necklaces, like, and she had multiple rings on every finger that were all like 12 times the size of what I was looking at. And at one point she's like, here, I'm going to help you out. If you really like this one, let me show you what it looks like with skin behind it. That's a thing. So she threw it on her finger. And my friend and I are like, we're leaning forward to see like, is this the one? Is this the ring? And whatever. We're leaning in real close. And all of a sudden my friend like falls over backwards. He's like, whoa, where'd it go? You know, because when it went on there was just so much bling on her hands. Like it just lost my little ring and this sea of diamonds, you know, this whole thing. And she cracks up, I'm cracking up, you know, I'm like, and I'm looking at this thing, trying to figure out like, is this the one? And if you go into a jewelry store, again, some free advice, maybe some of you all like know this, but like there's the four C's to ring shopping. You guys know this? Cut, color, clarity, carat weight. They'll teach you that at the store. They don't teach you that there's a fifth C, but everybody knows there's a fifth C. You know what the fifth C is? Cost. That's the most important one, right? So I'm at the store, we're walking through all these other four, and then the cost hits you. And that was the hardest question. Because like, when you're thinking about like the most incredible person you've ever met, like a person whose beauty is unmatched that you want to spend the rest of your life with them, how do you put a price tag on that? Like at what point, like you're like, ah, that's too much for them. You know, like, how do you do that? And so I brought cash with me. It was like all the cash I had. I brought cash. I paid for it in cash. I spent more on that ring than I'd spent on any other thing in my life to that point. And before you all like rush to the front and ask Stacy to see it, just remember what I said. I was a junior in college and wasn't necessarily swimming in cash. But let me ask you this question though, like real fundamentally, do you think she was worth it? And if he says no, I'm going to jump off the stage and punch you. All right. But do you think she was worth it? Do you think that that was a good investment? You know, if I had taken the money and spent it on like a mini donut maker, like skimped on the ring, got like a mini donut maker, like best of both worlds, right? Would that have been worth it? Like, we get that, right? I got no regrets. If I've got any regret when it comes to that ring, sorry, I looked at her for a second, shouldn't have done that. I wish I could have got her something bigger. Yeah? I love you, but I want you to ask that same question as we dive into this text today, like, not about my wife, but about Jesus. Like, is Jesus worth it? Was that a good investment? Because as we open up to Mark 14, what we get here in this kind of familiar story is an act of incredible love on display for Jesus. And that's the question. Is Jesus worth it? Was that a good investment? And as good Christian people were like, oh, of course it is. Like, Jesus, he's worthy of everything. I go, okay, then if that's true, if Jesus is worth it, then what does that mean for you and me? Like, if Jesus is worth this gift being given to him from this woman, and he's worthy of everything, then practically, what is that supposed to look like in our lives? You guys know this, I always love to take a text and try to summarize it as simply as possible. If you're taking notes. If I was to put this whole text into one word, I would just say worth. If I put it into a question, it would be, how much is Jesus worth to you? If I have to put it in a sentence, it would be this sentence. This is how you could summarize this whole text into these words, that it's incredibly beautiful when the worth of Jesus and the love of his followers match, and incredibly ugly when they don't. It's incredibly beautiful when the worth of Jesus and the love of his followers match, and incredibly ugly when they don't. What I want to start with this morning is looking just quickly at what happens when the worth of Jesus and the love of those around him doesn't match. And so look with me. We're going to actually start in a verse just before the text that we read this morning. Go to verse 1 and 2 and just kind of let your eyes glance over it, because this encounter with Jesus in verses 3 through 9 sits within this rejection sandwich. In verses 1 and 2, if you zoom in, what you see is you see the scribes and the Pharisees, and what they're doing is they should have been swamped with preparations to get God's people ready to celebrate the Lord for having delivered them out of slavery and out of Egypt. Instead, they're not swamped with preparations. They're scheming in secret over how to kill Jesus without a riot. His worth and their love don't match. And then if you zoom forward, like skip forward just a few verses and go from verse 2 to verse 10, now you see they got their answer. As one of Jesus' own disciples volunteers to betray Jesus. And these super ugly words right there, when they heard this, they were glad. They now had what they wanted. They had a way to kill Jesus without a riot, and Judas had what he wanted. Money. And it's not just outside this encounter, but it's also within this encounter that we see how ugly it can be when the worth of Jesus doesn't match the love of Jesus. Right? You saw in verse 4, it was just read here by Brooke, but some were expressing indignation to one another about this act of worship that's taking place. Some, who's the some? Matthew and his account, because he records the story, so does John in John 12. But in Matthew's account, in Matthew 26, he records that the some are the disciples. So this act of worship is taking place, and some that are infuriated by it are Jesus' own disciples. And then you go on to verse 5, and they began to, Jesus' disciples began to scold her. So in the midst of all of this mismatch, his worth not being matched with their love, this rejection sandwich that's around this encounter and within it, against this incredibly dark backdrop, this beautiful sparkling diamond is placed. This wedding diamond is placed with fullest light on it, held in contrast to all of this. Something so beautiful, something so good, something so right, something noteworthy that sticks out from everything else. So enough talking about what happens and how ugly it can be when the worth of Jesus and love for Jesus doesn't match. Let's talk about what happens when it does. So join me in verse 3. It says this, that while he, Jesus, was in Bethany, which is just this little village about 2 miles south and east of Jerusalem, while he, Jesus, was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at the table, a woman. And I want to pause for a second. Because Mark, and I don't know why, he doesn't name her, but we actually know who this woman is. Because if you read John's account in John 12, he names her. It's Mary. You're like, who's Mary? So this is Mary. That you remember the interaction when Jesus is at this house and there's two sisters, there's Mary and Martha. And it was Mary that was sitting at the feet of Jesus and Martha that was so busy, so preoccupied trying to entertain, to have the house ready, to get all the tasks in order, that she's like frantically going about the place. She even at a point gets so frustrated that Mary's not helping her out. She asks Jesus, can you tell my sister to help me? Right? And that story, every time I read that, I'm like, I am always a Martha, never a Mary. Anybody else know what I'm talking about? And this is what Jesus says to Martha. He says, Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has made the right choice, and it will not be taken away from her. Once again, in Mark 14, Mary is making the right choice. This is the same Mary who Mary and her sister Martha lost their brother Lazarus in John 11. You know that story? And as Jesus is walking toward and into Lazarus's funeral, it was Mary who came out second to him and said to Jesus in tears, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. You just declared it. I know it's true, Jesus. You are the resurrection and the life. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. And she weeps, and he joins her in her weeping. And having already declared that he is the resurrection and life, he goes and proves it by raising her brother from the dead. In John's account, that's John 11, and then her coming in with this alabaster jar and breaking it open and pouring it all over Jesus is John 12. It makes sense, right, when you see it in context, like maybe why Mary's heart was so moved in worship of Jesus, the resurrection and the life. This Mary came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume of pure nard, and she broke the jar and poured it on his head. I want to pause again here because I want you to feel this act of worship like in your bones this morning, okay? It says in verse 5, the disciples pointed out that pound of perfume, that's what John says, it's a full pound, could have been sold for 300 denarii. Which if you've got your Bible there, you might have like a little like letter next to that or a footnote that points down to something at the bottom that explains how much a denarii is worth. Anybody see that? It's equivalent to about a day's wage. So 300 denarii would be equivalent to almost a full year's salary, which very conservatively would be equivalent to about $25,000 to $30,000 in our money, right? That would catch your attention, right? You feel that? So she's bringing this perfume in, and she doesn't just, you know, take the lid off of it and like pour out just a little bit onto her hand, you know? Like she doesn't just like put like a couple droplets on the top of his head like we do with like essential oil into the machine, you know, whatever. It's like there's no dropper here. She just breaks the thing open. She smashes it. The perfume's going out. It's never going back in. She smashes the whole thing, and with that pound, she clearly has enough not just to cover his head, which is what Mark talks about here, and Matthew's account talks about how she poured it on his head, but in John's account, she covered not only his head, but his feet. And in John's account, then she unbinds her hair, which is crazy, because Jewish women never did that, especially not in public, but she unbinds her whole hair, head of hair, and then she gets on her knees and she wipes his feet with her hair and the perfume and just complete adoration and worship of Jesus. Do you feel that? Right, because it's in John's account too, then that Jesus washes the disciples' feet in John 13. We always talk about what an incredible act of love, of sacrificial love that is for them. Right, because not even servants were required to wash their master's feet. What does it say then about Mary when she's got his feet in her hands and she's wiping his feet with her hair? Do you feel that? This is incredible. This act of worship is incredible. Guys, if you want to know what it looks like when somebody finds their greatest joy in Jesus, this is it. Like every Sunday when you walk into this building, the light reflects that onto the floor, right? You've seen the mission statement of our church, helping people find their greatest joy in Jesus. If you want to know what it looks like when somebody finds their greatest joy in Jesus, this is it. It's right here. It's on full display in front of us. And I want to use this encounter to show us three indicators that somebody has found their greatest joy in Jesus. Okay, here's the first thing we see in Mary, that when you find your greatest joy in Jesus, what was once of greatest value to you, you now place at Jesus's feet. That's the first indicator that you found your greatest joy in Jesus, that what was once of greatest value to you, you now place at Jesus's feet. When you find your greatest joy in Jesus, you have a new orienting center. And your adoration knows no moderation. This looks like something. You can't just say that you found your greatest joy in Jesus. It will look like something. Let me just unpack this a little bit more from Mary's point of view. Understand this, that in Mary's like day and age, a woman couldn't work and earn significant wages. So there's no way that she actually had worked and earned up the ability to buy this for herself. Most scholars believe that this was likely a family heirloom. It was passed down to her from a previous generation as a gift. This jar had likely sat in her house for years, carrying tremendous sentimental value. And here she's taking this item of great value to her and her family, and she's placing it at the feet of Jesus. Beyond just the sentimental value, which is one thing, let me add something else to it, right? I said before that women couldn't work in that day and age and gain significant wages. And on top of that, in the five times that Mary is mentioned in the Gospels, there's never a mention of a husband. Add to that, her brother just recently died and was miraculously raised to life. So who knows about his health condition and all that stuff, right? But you have a woman that this would have been for her financial security, her comfort, her nest egg, right? Her parachute, right? To make sure that if all of a sudden life fell apart, she had something that would hold her up. And she is taking this comfort, this security, and placing it at the feet of Jesus. Not part of it, all of it. Not only did it have sentimental value and financial value, add on to this, and maybe this hardly needs to even be mentioned, but right, she gives it to Jesus as a way of preparing him for his burial. Well, she could have kept it for her own. Right? But something in her was aware enough to recognize the best way to prepare myself for my burial is to prepare Jesus for his. And she takes it and she lays it at Jesus' feet. I think the thing that catches us here is like, guys, we're so accustomed to watching people give Jesus their leftovers that when somebody actually engages in true, pure worship, it's shocking. Like it's shocking to us when we see somebody take $25,000 and instead of saving that for retirement or using it to buy something bigger, nicer, bigger, better, whatever, they lay it before Jesus. We get shocked when we see somebody say no to a bigger job, more responsibilities, new activities, new roles and responsibilities, because they're done being too busy for church. They're done being too busy for connection group and pouring into other people. I can't stand that anymore. I'm going to say no to those things so that I can lay my time before Jesus. Like we get shocked when people do that. We get shocked when people would take their relationship and place that before Jesus. Like shocked when somebody goes, I know that Jesus desires for me to walk in purity. And I know that he desires for me to save sex until marriage. Like we get shocked when we see somebody actually step forward on their wedding day and is a virgin. Like we get shocked that people would take their relationship and place it before Jesus. We get shocked when people are walking through cancers and sicknesses and other trials and in the midst of those things, still praising Jesus because they've even taken their health and laid it at the feet of Jesus. Like all of these things, we get shocked when people do any of these things, right? And lay them before Jesus, our money, our time, our relationships, our health. To take the things of greatest value to us and lay them before Jesus. We get shocked when people do that because we're so used to seeing people giving Jesus their leftovers. But when you find your greatest joy in Jesus, this is point number two, you're going to do things that shock people, that seem crazy, that seem nuts, that people will look at and they go, I don't get it. Because those around Mary, when she's breaking this jar of perfume and pouring it all over Jesus, and it's not just, again, the value of it, it's how she used it. When they're looking at Jesus, Mary, they think she's gone crazy. They think she's nuts. And she didn't seem to care. It's crazy. We'll do this with other things, right? Like every day around the world, we will pack stadiums out. We will paint our faces. We'll shave letters on our chest. We will go to playoff football games in -4 degree temperatures with our shirts off and watch the Dolphins play the Chiefs, which we knew who was going to win that game going into it. There's no way Miami can win in cold weather. We know that, right? What's crazy, I actually read this story. Do you know like a handful of people, no pun intended, where this story goes, a handful of people had to like have fingers and toes amputated because they went to that game? And some, they didn't even go to watch the game. They just went for Taylor Swift, which you lose a finger for that. I guess it's deserved. I'm kidding. Kidding. Right, well, we do things all the time that seem careless and wasteful and extravagant and beyond what is necessary. Like we do this, like even with my kids, like every time like a birthday comes rolling around, all of a sudden, like whatever we had budgeted for it, I'm like, whatever, what do they want? You know, like, I just want to give it to them. Like we get so carefree and extravagant and generous with other things, even wasteful. Why don't we do that with Jesus? Since it's St. Patrick's Day, and maybe some of you are sitting here right now being like, wait, it's St. Patrick's Day? I didn't wear green. I see some in the room that are wearing green, so you get to pinch everybody else. Congratulations. It's a weird thing. But since it is St. Patrick's Day, I want to tell you the true and crazy story about St. Patrick. Or if I was to use his real name, it's Maywin Suquet. Guys, Maywin, as a 16-year-old boy, was on a holiday with his family when Irish raiders came up on a ship and captured him and took him to Ireland as a slave. When he was taken captive, Maywin wasn't a Christian, but his dad was a church deacon. So he had grown up in the church, and while in slavery, he remembering all the things that his dad had taught him, he surrendered his life to Christ. He was in slavery for 6 years, and at the age of 22, he had a vision one night where he felt God tell him, get up, go to the coast, there's a boat waiting for you. So he got up, he ran away from his slave master, went 200 miles to the coast and found a boat, which took him aboard, and he went home to Britain and saw his family for the first time in 6 years. It's crazy, right? Here's where it gets nutty. After spending a number of years with his friends and family and growing in his knowledge of Christ, that he was compelled by the gospel to go back to Ireland. Looked at all of his friends and family and said, I believe I need to go back to my slave master, to all the people, and share Jesus with them. They thought he was nuts. And over the course of his time ministering to the people of Ireland for 30 to 40 years, he was threatened. He was rejected. He was even enslaved for a short season of time. They even tried to kill him. He wrote about his own life. He said this, daily I expect to be murdered or betrayed or reduced to slavery if the occasion arises, but I fear nothing because of the promises of heaven. That's crazy, right? Right? Who does that? Escapes slavery and then goes back to them. It's tough to get accurate information, especially with numbers. But the best I can find in my research, Patrick served in Ireland for 30 to 40 years, and in that time saw 135,000 people give their life to Christ and planted 300 churches. And And so today is St. Patrick's Day, which is a holiday that it's often kind of connected with wearing green, drinking beer, leprechauns and shamrock decorations, which the shamrock was actually the way that he would explain with its three leaves the Trinity to people when he was sharing the gospel. But we celebrate March 17th because that's the day that we believe that May Wynn or Patrick died after a life of sacrifice for Jesus. Let me ask this question. Do you think Jesus is worth it? Like, do you think that was worth it? Here's a little tool I'd love to pass on to you. It's called the and then what test. And here's why the and then what test helps you with is if you're looking at something in life and going, is this worth my time? Is this worth my money? Is this worth my investment, my energy, whatever? You can run it through the and then what test and figure out if that thing is worth it. So you could do that with Patrick's life. Patrick, you go back to those people. Maybe you're effective. Maybe they kill you. And then you go, okay, and then what? Maybe you're effective. Maybe you lead a bunch of people to Jesus. Maybe you plant a bunch of churches. Like, and then what? And then you die, or maybe they kill you. And then you go be with Jesus. And then what? And he's going to look at you and say, well done, good and faithful servant. I go, okay, like, that's the and then what test, right? Let's try this in another way. Let's talk about most people's dreams of retirement. And guys, I'm a fan of retirement. I think retirement's great. Like, I love the thought of like being freed up and having flexibility from different responsibilities and stuff for so many people. I'm like, that will be great. The bummer is when the idea of retirement and what it should be for Jesus becomes hijacked by something else. Here's what I mean. Most people, when they're thinking about retirement, are thinking about what's that warm location I'm gonna go to portions of the year? What are those golf courses that I'm going to get to actually have time to go golf endless hours at? Sadly, for most, what retirement becomes is it becomes, and I don't even think that this is like at first intentional, but it becomes an opportunity, an excuse to disengage from church, to withdraw just a little bit from community. Because I got these things. I'm kind of split between multiple worlds and, you know, I got grandkids, all that, which I'm like, I get, I'm like, that's great. But sadly, you take years of your life that you have such vibrant gifts to bring to the church, so much to offer to anybody around you, men, women, or children, or you name it, to disciple, to take the things that you've learned about Christ and pass it on to other people, and you squander those years picking up seashells on shorelines or golfing in places with no unbeliever within sight. And I go, why? So yeah, you do. You go play your endless hours of golf, and then what? Yeah, you might get to spend more and more hours each year at your timeshare, and then what? And then what? And then what? And then what happens is eventually you break down, your body breaks down, you die, and that's it. Or if I bring it into my world, like something that my wife and I are trying to navigate is the youth sports world, right? Like, it's so hard for me as a parent, especially look at my kids who love something, enjoy something so much. And in some ways, I think they're decent enough at it. That's like, when they're like, I want to do more, I'm like, I get it. And to look at them and say, no. That doesn't mean we say no to everything, but we got to walk this fine line, because what I've watched and some of my peers and other families, I'm like, man, you can chase, you can pursue that youth sports God, but in pursuing that, you lose your soul. Or if not your soul, you lose your child's soul. You maybe gained the youth sports God, but you lost it. You lost your soul. But maybe my son's gonna grow up, or my daughter's gonna grow up to be a college athlete. I go, great, and then what? Well, they might even be so good they could become a pro. I go, and then what? Well, they might make lots of money and they could be famous. And I go, and then what? Well, I don't know, and then what? What happened after this? Well, and then what happens to every professional athlete is eventually they have to stop playing a game. They got to start living life like everybody else. And eventually that life ends like it does for everybody. And then what? That's the and then what test. It makes sense? Many people thought Mary was crazy. Many people thought Patrick was crazy. And maybe for a while they thought they were crazy too. But and then what? Here's what I think is crazy when I read this text, is that you have Jesus in the house of Simon the leper and all of these people around him. And in just a few short days, he's gonna go to the cross, pay the full price for all of their sins, and stamp this word guarantee across all of his promises of heaven for them. And she's the only one pouring perfume on him. That's crazy to me. Additionally, what I think is crazy is when we orient our lives around things and pursue things and work to compile stacks of cash, all of these things that won't matter at all 1,000 years from now. That's crazy. If I could give one encouragement to everybody in the room today, can I give you a new ambition for your life? Can you make the ambition of your life to give yourself to something that is gonna matter 1,000 years from now? Can you just look at the things in your life that you orient around, that you pursue, that you give your best efforts to you, and can you do the and then what test and ask the question, will it matter 1,000 years from now? And find something that will matter 1,000 years from now. I want to give myself to something that will not only matter 1,000 years from now, but if God gave me 1,000 lifetimes, like a do-over again and again and again, I would continue to give myself to the thing that I'm giving myself to right now because it's worth not only 1 lifetime, but 1,000 lifetimes. Guys, I don't say this like to gloat or anything, but I just want to say this because I love y'all so much. Like, guys, I've found that in this place. I found that in you. I found that in this community, in the Cedar Valley, something that is worth giving 1,000 lifetimes to, something that will matter 1,000 years from now, to see lostness eradicated from the Cedar Valley completely. And maybe it's not here that you're called to, the work here, it's someplace else. I go, give yourself to something that will actually matter for eternity. There's many people that will have regrets on the day of their death. Mary and Patrick aren't two of them. They're not in that group. So when you find your greatest joy in Jesus, not only will you take what was once of greatest value to you and you'll lay it at the feet of Jesus, but people are gonna think you're nuts. That's indicator number one, and number two, that you find your greatest joy in Jesus. Here's indicator number three. That you do all of those things voluntarily. Voluntarily. Notice here that no one is making Mary do this. No one. Jesus never told her to do it. She's not bringing this perfume and pouring it all over Jesus because he told her to do it, or he even demanded that she do it. She's doing it because he deserves it. I think the biggest shocker in all this, I mean, if I pull back and go, okay, what does this passage tell me about Jesus? I mean, Mary, what she did here is noteworthy, but what does this passage tell me about Jesus? Here's the biggest shocker in this whole text. I'm shocked that when she laid out such an extravagant gift that Jesus accepted it. I mean, like, how non-Iowan of Jesus? Like, because you guys know the unwritten rules of being an Iowan, right? Like, if somebody's gonna give you an extravagant gift, you have to at least turn it down once, right? You guys know what I'm talking about? Like how this works? Somebody brings you a plate of Scotcheroos, you're like, I couldn't, you know? Please, give them to somebody else more deserving. Like, that's just the Iowan thing. Like, oh, not for me, right? And we rest of like, okay, fine, right? Then somebody gives it to you, right? Like, Jesus doesn't do that. But what you have here in this moment, you have the most self-sacrificial and humble person, justice seeking as all get out, poor conscious person in the entire planet in Jesus Christ. And she's bringing out this expensive gift, probably the greatest possession she had in life. She's pouring it out on him. And he looks at her and goes, you're right, do it. Pour it on. That's shocking. But what it tells us about Jesus is that it tells us that he's worth it. When the most self-sacrificial person on the entire planet says, no, pour it on, this is right, you know that he's worth it. He's worth you taking the thing of greatest value and you laying it at his feet. And in this moment, this beautiful reality hits that not only was that the right thing to do for her, like, and that like Jesus is worth it, it was also the best thing for her. Because as Jesus looks at Mary, who has now let her hands go free of this precious, valuable thing that she once held so dear and lays it at the feet of Jesus, he knows that while her hands are more loose and free from that, she's never been more tied and secured to him. Which is the best thing for her too. That's the beauty. These things aren't mutually exclusive. This is just for Jesus' good and bummer for her. Like when we find our greatest joy in Jesus and lay down what was once valuable to us, we do the crazy thing. We do it voluntarily. That's the greatest thing that could happen for us too. And it's the right thing for Jesus. He's worthy and he knows it. You know, it's likely that when they pressed the crown of thorns onto Jesus' head and they nailed his hands and feet to the cross, that his hair and his hands, his feet still smelled of Mary's perfume. Our text ends with this promise where Jesus says, "Truly I tell you, whenever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." And the fact that we have this story in our Bibles is a fulfillment of Jesus' promise to her, of him celebrating her and her extravagant gift, an act of love. But in just a few short days, when that perfumed hair and those perfumed feet are being stabbed with thorns and nailed to a cross, what was once, what seemed like at a moment, like a really extravagant gift, now in comparison to what Jesus offers in the ultimate gift, the extravagance begins to fade a bit, right? Mary's gift and all of that, you go from like a wow to like it's still a wow, but like compared to that, wow, Jesus, wow. And a reminder for us that as no matter how much you give to Jesus, you cannot outgive him. You cannot outgive God. So I come back to this question, guys. How much is Jesus worth? And I'm going to make it real personal. How much is Jesus worth to you? And what does that look like? To the religious leaders of Jesus' day, Jesus wasn't worth more than a common criminal. To Judas, Jesus was worth about $1,000. 30 pieces of silver is about $1,000. To Mary, he was worth everything that she had. And I would encourage you today to be a Mary, because it's an incredibly beautiful thing when the worth of Jesus and love for Jesus in our life matches. How much is Jesus worth to you? What does that look like in your life? What's most precious to you that you need to lay before Jesus' feet this morning? What's the thing that you need to do that others would think is crazy, but you don't care anymore? What's the investment you need to make that will matter 1,000 years from now? And know this, whatever it is, whatever you lay at his feet, Jesus is worth it. He's worth it. Let's pray. Now, Father, we just want to say thank you. And I've been fixated on that word regret because I don't want to end this life with any regrets. I want to hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant, Lord." I want to give myself to something that will actually matter for all of eternity, because 1,000 years from now, that's all I'll care about. And so I pray that Jesus, today you would create a proper orientation in our lives, where when we find our greatest joy in you, it just shifts everything else down and puts them in the proper place. It doesn't mean that we don't have joy in other things, but it puts them in the proper perspective, that in light of us having our greatest joy in you, everything else sits where it should. Because God, you're worthy of it all. And we love you so, so much. Amen.
This has been a message from Candeo Church. To learn more about us or to hear more messages, visit us at CandeoChurch.com.